David Bartemus was 73 years old and undergoing treatment for a recurrence of cancer when he made an impulsive decision. He would travel across the world to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. David Bartemus has written about that decision, his cancer, and his journey to Tanzania with the group Above and Beyond Cancer in the new book, We Call Her Keely. I'll talk with him. Then later in the hour, the journeys of Above and Beyond Cancer continue. This summer, Dr. Richard Deming, the founder of the group and a team of cancer survivors, participated in the 3,000-mile Race Across America bicycle race. We'll talk about that journey. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On New Year's Day of this year, a group of 19 cancer survivors and 21 caregivers set off on a journey to go to Africa, to Tanzania, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. The trip was sponsored by the group Above and Beyond Cancer. Later this hour, I'll talk with the founder of that group, Dr. Richard Deming, about another journey that the group has taken. But first, the ages of the cancer survivors on that trip ranged from age 33 to age 73, and my guest today was the 73-year-old. David Bartemus has written about his journey in the new book, We Call Her Keely. Hello, David.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
Let's talk first a little bit about the history of your cancer. You were first diagnosed with cancer when you were 50 years old. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, at that time, I went for an annual physical, and my practitioner said he found a lump and that it needed to be checked out. He made an appointment for me with a local urologist, and he confirmed that. And then I went through some counsel concerning whether it would be radiation or surgery. I elected to go to the Mayo Clinic, and while I was there, I was convinced that I needed to have the surgery.
You went through with surgery at that point, and what other kinds of treatment did you have to go through?
Well, at that time, it was merely wait and watch. And for the next 12 or 13 years, everything was fine. The surgery seemed to work well. However, after 12 or 13 years, my PSA went pretty high, in the 50s, and we decided that we needed to have radiation. I had Dr. Deming was the radiologist, oncologist here in Des Moines, and that was about 2001 or 2002. The radiation, the immediate results seemed to be very good. However, after about 6 or 9 months, the PSA went up again.
And when you say PSA, what are you talking
about? Prostate-specific antigen.
Okay.
That's a blood test that they do to determine if there are anti-antigens present. And when there are antigens present, that indicates the cancer is present.
So the results showed that the cancer was coming back?
Yes, it did. So the next stage was hormone treatment. And I am continuing in hormone treatment at present, and I am in remission.
And that brings us to pretty much the present. You were 73 years old when all of a sudden you decided that you wanted to go on a trip to Tanzania to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Tell me about your life at the moment when you made that decision. You had been retired for some time doing work in the church.
That's correct. My life at that time was a very well-planned retired life. My family has an acreage in southern Iowa. I'd spent a great deal of time developing a tree farm there, and I was very active in the Iowa Woodland Owners Association. And so it was very upsetting when the cancer came back, but I got over that after a bit. Well, one day I was reading about Above and Beyond Cancer and in the local paper, and they mentioned the trip to Kilimanjaro, and it just struck me as something that I wanted to do. I wanted to do that, and I immediately sent Dr. Deming an email and Charlie Whitmack, the executive director of Above and Beyond, and they responded within hours and said, well, you're on the list. So the next couple of months, while I was on the list, continued to prepare at a local gym. Where
Let's go back just a little
bit.
What did your wife say when you said, hey, honey, I just signed up to go on a trip all the way across the world to climb one of the tallest peaks in the world?
Well, my wife is not an impulsive person. My wife initially just sort of nodded and took it all in. However, after a few days, she started asking me questions, and some of the questions that she was asking were questions that needed to be asked. How was I going to deal with my gastrointestinal problems that are separate and distinct from the cancer? How was I going to travel? How well would that go with me? And what about my physical condition at age 73? Climbing Kilimanjaro is not an easy task. And I just kept thinking that this was something I wanted to do. My grandchildren and children all chimed in very positively. But as my wife continued to question, they also questioned.
Well, and you had made, as you point out, an impulsive decision to go. Did your wife's questions help you come up with a reason why this was important to you?
Yes, it did. Her questions, of course, go beyond my discomfort. Her questions would look at her discomfort. You know, what would happen if something happened to me? And I had to be sensitive to that. But we discussed it, and I was insistent that I wanted to go. And so she said, if that's the way you want to do it, go.
Let's talk about your physical condition, not to sound like your wife here, but you know, you were 73 years old. You had been an athlete in your youth, but you were not really an athlete at that point in time. What was your physical condition?
I was overweight. I was, as you age, the weight is above the waist, and the legs that were so muscular in youth looked like toothpicks. So even though I was working out on somewhat a regular basis, I was still not in nearly as good a condition as I thought I was, as I would learn later, that I really needed more conditioning.
How long did you have to get ready for the trip?
Well, I had been working out about 3 years before I even applied. And then we had about 2 months. Of intensive workouts.
Wow. And how did that start? How did you put together a program to get ready?
Well, Above and Beyond has trainers that who are very good. And I had a trainer. Her name was Mary Von Heukelum. And Mary guided me through those 2 months, meeting with me every Friday, giving me a program to follow, upper body program, a lower body program, a mid body program. And I really credit her a great deal for getting me as good as I was before we left.
Was that kind of a shock to the system to be working out in such a focused and intense way?
The shock was more mental than it was physical. I could not get out of my mind the fact that I couldn't run for any great distance without completely being out of gas. In my youth, I was a distance swimmer. And this was just totally contrary to the way I envisioned my abilities to be. So I had to reconcile that. Going up the mountain in training, I was always the last one. Everybody else could go a little bit faster. Everybody else could go and not breathe quite as hard. So that was a mental thing that I had to overcome.
You had to really come to terms with where you were physically.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You also had to come to terms with your body post-cancer as well. You write a lot about how difficult it was for you to change in the locker room, because now you're at a different gym than the one you were working out in at home. You weren't changing clothes before you went. You were in a position where you needed to change clothes or shower afterward. Why was the locker room so difficult for you?
The locker room was difficult for me because for many, many years, I hadn't changed in front of other people. Maybe there's a cultural connection there, possibly. The other part was that when I change, I have to change a pad because I drip urine, and I didn't want people to know that.
And that's a result of the cancer treatments.
That was a result of the treatments. That's right. It took me a while to get past that. At first, I would go to a room, and it was kind of strange room. It was called a changing room. But the lights, it had been used so little that the lights were burned out and nobody knew it.
So you were changing all alone in the dark.
I would change all alone in the dark. And I just had to start to come to grips with that and realize that men change in front of men all the time. I needed to get past that. And I needed to get past the idea that if someone were to see me changing a pad, then that was their problem if they had a problem with it, not mine. The fact is, when you work out a lot, the dripping is worse. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, for inexplicable reasons, you simply gush urine. So without a pad, I couldn't have been working out at all. So I had to get past that. For one reason, what cancer does to you is it somewhat feminizes you. The most convenient pad that I could find was a feminine pad. So not only was the issue of just being in view when I changed a pad, but the pad would be recognized as a feminine pad.
So already the cancer had, in a way, threatened your manhood. And now you had to be in public.
That's
displaying
right.
That.
That's right.
We need to take a break, Dave. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more about your journey. My guest is David Bartimus. He's written about his journey to Tanzania to climb Mount Kilimanjaro with the group Above and Beyond Cancer. He and the others left on January 1st of 2012. And we'll talk more in a moment. His book is called We Call Her Keely. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Dave Bartimus. He has written a book about a journey that he took earlier this year. In January, he, along with 19 or 18 other cancer survivors and 21 caregivers, set off on a journey to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. The trip was sponsored and organized by the group Above and Beyond Cancer. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll also talk about another journey undertaken by Above and Beyond Cancer. The founder of the group, Dr. Richard Deming, will be here. I'll also talk to another cancer survivor who participated in the 3,000-mile bicycle race across America this summer. David Bartimus was the oldest member of that journey to Mount Kilimanjaro at age 73. And Dave, just before the break, we were talking about the training that you had to do and how you had to overcome your fear of changing in the public locker room. And in reading your book, in some ways, it sounds like getting through that hurdle, being courageous enough to own your body and change in a public place, seemed to be, in some ways, the biggest hurdle that you had to overcome on this journey.
I think that might well be true. The other big part of the hurdle was writing about it. I think writing about it gave me the freedom to know that I can move on. So the hurdle, just realizing it wasn't enough, but to sit down and put it in words and first share it with my wife, who said, gosh, sounds like you're taking your clothes off in public. And I agreed with her, and we talked about it a while before I let anybody else read it.
You had to make yourself very vulnerable to write this book, but you also found, and you write about this as well, that as you spent time with other cancer survivors in very intimate settings, you started sharing more about your experience and your cancer with them, and they with you. I think that was part of this journey too.
Absolutely it was. It was really the first time that I had shared with others. And it was the first time that I became aware that other people had, if not the same burden, an equal burden, and in some cases, a greater burden. And that was particularly true of the women on the journey. I came to admire and respect the women so much. As I grew up, if young girl were to play sports, she was considered odd or unusual. It wasn't until after Title IX that women started to pay attention to their physical bodies in terms of strength and athletics. These women really impressed me as people who knew and understood their bodies. They knew and understood that they could accomplish anything they set their mind to. And some of these women were people who had been through chemotherapy, very difficult therapies in order to be there and to accomplish this.
And, of course, many of them at a very young age.
Yes.
You had to go through all of this. Let's talk about the journey itself. So you had 2 months to get ready physically. Mm-hmm. You set out on January 1st. Did you feel ready?
Yes, I did. I was very confident at that point. The confidence was soon shattered. The flight over was a very ordinary flight, not too many distractions. A couple of the members of the team were late getting over. But the flight for me was long, arduous in terms of just sitting. But the first day that we were there, first full day, we went on a short hike to a local canyon at Marangu Falls near Moshe. And we went down into that canyon, a very rickety railings, very steep, slippery, wet. And going down wasn't so hard. It was coming back up. Coming back up, I really fell behind. I fell probably 200 yards behind the rest. Someone took my pack. That was a bit embarrassing. I really wanted to do it on my own. But at that point, I started to realize that if I were going to do it, it was going to be a cooperative venture, and I would have to rely on other people much more than I would ordinarily.
So that first day must have scared you.
It did scare me. It scared me from a couple of points of view. One of the first things I learned in Tanzania was that lunch is usually around 3 p.m. and supper is closer to 8 p.m. And that's the worst thing for my gastrointestinal problems. I usually can't eat anything after about 5 or 6 p.m. So I knew I was going to be in trouble from that point of view. But on the other hand, the food was very good. It was very tasty until we started up the mountain.
You had to exercise a lot of self-control, and you were writing about how you would not eat dinner at 9 o'clock. You would just, mm-hmm. Eat a larger lunch and skip dinner or eat a very small portion of something. But here you were also at a point where you had to be so physically strong. Did you feel like you were compromising your strength and your energy by not eating enough?
I think in retrospect, that's probably true. But at the time, I did not realize that. At the time, I would eat a protein bar in the afternoon so that I would have a very light dinner when they served dinner, or skip it altogether. They had toast and honey. The toast going up the mountain was usually cold by the time you got it. The honey was very tasty and a lot of energy there. So I relied on things like that, the protein bars. I relied on the honey and the toast. Eggs were not presented very appetizingly once you started up the mountain. So to answer your question directly, at that time I did not realize it, but looking back, I think it did impact me.
When you started climbing, how did things go?
First day went very well. I really enjoyed it. Oh, the scenery is absolutely spectacular. The geology is fascinating, and the more you learn about it, the more you really love it. The porters were wonderful. I have great admiration for them and their physical strength, as well as their constant encouragement and their friendliness. The Tanzanian people are very friendly people. So the first day was fine. At night, I had difficulties because I have to get up several times at night. That presented quite a lot of difficulties because once you start out across this tent field that's strewn with rocks of all sizes, you're in the dark, you're quickly lost. So I had trouble finding the latrine. I had trouble finding my tent, almost went in a wrong tent. I don't know whether it was male or female, but I eventually found my way back to the tent. And that first night went fairly well. The second day was the longest day of the climb. We expected to be in camp by 4 p.m. We didn't get in camp until after 7. It was pitch dark by the time we got there, and that made it very difficult to arrange for the evening. During the night, again, I had the difficulties of getting up, finding a way out of the tent and to the latrine and back. And the next day, it was physically I was doing okay. Unfortunately, midway through the morning, I started to feel a lot of compression in my stomach. I started to feel ill. And took some medicine for that, and everything was fine. By the time we got into camp, even though it was very late, I was still well enough and felt good enough to vest with my Alban stole and join Monsignor Bagnano as he celebrated Mass, and I assisted. So I was feeling pretty good then. During that night, though, the cramps came back, and they came rapidly and with horrible results.
So you had terrible diarrhea basically on the trip up the mountain. You felt better for a while, and then at night you had to get up. You couldn't make it to the latrine. It just sounds incredibly miserable. Your clothes were dirty.
Yes.
You were freezing.
Yes.
And it sounds like it must have been, in spite of having gone through cancer, one of the lowest moments of your life.
Well, it was a low moment because it was a moment of feeling as if I were failing. And that was very difficult for me. I've had a good life. I've failed very little. So failing just wasn't something I wanted to accept.
You had, on this trip, there were 19 cancer survivors and 21 caregivers. So clearly there were people there who could take care of you. What kind of medical care did you get in the morning?
Well, the next morning, when I got up, I literally could not stand. And I fumbled my way out of the tent, desperate to find the latrine. I was met at the tent by two doctors, Dr. Deming and another physician who was with us. And they literally caught me under the armpits as I was about to fall. I was dehydrated to the point, and my legs had cramped to the point where I couldn't support my weight. They helped me get to the latrine, but it was too late. By this time, most of my clothes were soiled, but I wasn't quite ready to give up at that point right then and there. It was just later when Dr. Deming asked me if I wanted to give up, and I could read in his voice that he was suggesting that I do so. So that was the most difficult part, to actually say, yeah, I better go back down.
And what did that mean at that point, to give up? How did you even get back down?
They had porters who were designated to go down with us. There were two others that also chose to go down at that point. And so we went down. They told us it would be about 20 minutes, and it took closer to 2 hours. And we found a Jeep trail, and they had a Jeep there. So we didn't have to go all the way down through the mountain or on the mountain as we had come up.
But after that horrible night, getting to the point where you felt like you physically could not go on, you did have to go on a two-hour hike.
Yes.
When you got in that Land Rover, that Suburban, what was going through your mind?
Well, the first thing that was going through my mind is I'm sitting on the wrong side of this thing, because they drive on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side of the road, and it was very uncomfortable. And there was a person sitting in the middle, and I think she was even more uncomfortable. But the thing that bothered me the most about giving up was that by this time I was feeling good again. I was starting to feel like I need to go back. I need to go back and catch up with the others. And probably that had to do with reacclimation to altitude. But in any event, the decision had been made.
Dave, you did a remarkable thing. I mean, even those 3 days hiking up a mountain, carrying a pack most of the time, as a 73-year-old man who'd been through three different bouts with cancer, that was a remarkable accomplishment. But there you were, beating yourself up. And it took you a long time to let go of that. Have you let go of it now?
I don't think so. In fact, if you read the final verses of my poem in the book, I state very clearly I want to go back. And I want to do it again. And this time I want to top out.
You spent some time exploring Tanzanian culture a little bit in the days after, and then you returned home with the rest of the team. What do you think you've taken away from this experience, other than your determination to overcome and do it again?
What I took away was a respect for people who have to go through very difficult times in their life, and the respect I have for them. And by that, I mean not just cancer survivors. As I walked through the marketplace in Moshi and met the Tanzanian people and visited with some for some period of time, like an hour, 2 hours at a time, they have a journey to make too, because it's not an easy culture to live in. And it's just a culture where only certain people are going to make it out of poverty. The rest are going to be there, and that is their cancer. So what I'm taking out of it is a respect for all people, a respect for whatever life people are able to pull up for themselves, because that's really where the people of Tanzania are. They have to pull themselves up. But at the same time, they do work with each other.
How did it change how you think about yourself?
I'm not nearly as good an athlete as I once thought, that's for sure. I think it gave me the courage to write about something that men are seldom able to do or to talk about it. And I speak not just about the incontinence in the book, but about the ultimate result of the hormone therapy, which is impotence. And I think we need to know that and understand that, because it is part of aging, and all of us are going to age. So my bottom line is that I don't think I'm afraid to die, and I don't think I'm afraid of the process of dying. I know that that's ultimately going to be, whether I get hit by a truck or whether the cancer comes back, I don't know. But that's where I am with it. I really feel like whatever God chooses for me, I am willing to accept.
Dave, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
And give yourself a little more credit.
Okay.
The book is called We Call Her Keeley. I was talking with Dave Bartimus, who was part of a group of 19 cancer survivors and 21 caregivers who set off on a journey to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in January of this year with the group Above and Beyond Cancer. In a moment, I'll talk with Dr. Richard Deming. He's the founder of the group Above and Beyond Cancer. He, along with another team of cancer survivors, participated in a bicycle race across America this summer. I'll also talk to another one of the racers as well in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've spent this hour so far talking about a journey that was taken by 19 cancer survivors and 21 caregivers in January to climb Mount Kilimanjaro with the group Above and Beyond Cancer. Now we're going to talk about another journey that has been undertaken by that group. This summer, in June, a team of cancer survivors participated in a 3,000-mile race across America, bicycle race, and the founder of that group is with me today, Dr. Richard Deming. He's also the director of Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. Hello, Dr. Deming.
Hello, Charity. Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And also with us is Drennan Fisher. She is a 38-year-old breast cancer survivor, a mother of two, an attorney from Cumming, Iowa, and she was on the team that participated in this race. Hello, Drennan.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Deming, we were just talking about this climb up Mount Kilimanjaro. I know that a team of cancer survivors also climbed the base camp at Mount Everest. Those were great feats of physical strength, but this was a race, a bicycle race. This wasn't just a feat of strength, but participating in a competition. Why did you decide that that would be a good idea to put together a team to participate
in
the race?
Yeah, great question, Charity. And by the way, I had a chance to listen to your interview with Dave Bartimus. What an inspirational man. He really embodies what it's like for a cancer survivor who has gained confidence and courage from the cancer journey to reach above and beyond what is one's comfort zone to try to do something that you're not even sure you can do. And the journey to Everest Base Camp and then the journey to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro were amazing journeys. In some way, though, they were done on our own time schedule. We could go very slowly, methodically, and as I told them many, many times, all you have to do is one more step, a million more times, and we've got it made. The difference with the Race Across America is we weren't doing just a cancer advocacy bicycle ride. This was a race. This was the 31st year of the Race Across America, a bicycle race. And if we didn't go fast enough, we would actually get disqualified. So part of the purpose of doing the Race Across America as Above and Beyond Cancer was, you know, part of it is the adversity leading to personal growth and taking on a challenge that you're not sure that you can actually do and putting yourself on the line. But it's also to show that cancer doesn't have to limit you. And I can confess now something that I didn't tell the group before we started. I was really afraid. I knew that if we had all the time in the world, yes, we could ride our bicycles across country, but I wasn't sure that our group would actually be able to make the time cutoff in Durango. And I was concerned, gosh, how are we going to spin this story about cancer survivors being able to do whatever they want if we ended up getting disqualified?
Well, and tell us how the race works so people can understand this incredible incredible challenge. This was a 3,000-mile race, and you did it nonstop. You took turns riding.
Yes, we competed as a team, and again, it's a race. We had 8 members of the cycling team, but then we also had 12 crew members, some of whom were cancer survivors as well. So as an 8-person team, only one person cycles at a time. And it's a 3,000-mile bicycle race from Oceanside, California to Annapolis, Maryland. It goes across 12 states. It's up and over the coastal mountains, down across the desert, up through Arizona, over the Continental Divide of Colorado, then across the plains and across the Appalachian Mountains. And in this journey, you climb 150,000 feet, about 5 times the height of Mount Everest, as we keep pedaling day and night, 24/7. And it's a race, so you actually have checkpoints. And if you're not going fast enough, you're disqualified.
And you just have to quit.
You officially do not finish. I mean, they're public roads, so they couldn't actually kick you off the roads, but you do not get a time. We were competing against 18 other 8-person teams on this journey. And our secret weapon was this higher purpose we had. We knew why we were there. We weren't there because we were bicycle racers that were just attempting to get another victory. None of us had actually competed in a bicycle race before. Some of us had done some triathlons. So this was the very first bicycle race that this group undertook. And it just happened to be the most grueling endurance bicycle race on the planet.
Well, Drennan, let's talk a little bit about your story. As I mentioned, you're 38 years old. You are a breast cancer survivor. You were diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer while you were pregnant with your second child, which is a nightmare I think most of us can't even begin to imagine. Then you went pretty much straight into treatment for that cancer after your daughter was born, and straight from treatment to training for this race?
Yeah, that's correct. I, as you said, I was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer when I was 9 months pregnant, and I had to immediately have my daughter. She was born 4 weeks early, then I went into 5 months of dose dense chemotherapy. And after that, I had surgery, and actually 2 surgeries, the last of which was in November of 2011. And while I was recovering from surgery, I just happened to be reading the paper, and I saw a piece in the Register that about Above and Beyond and the Everest journey that they took, and that they were planning upcoming journeys to Kilimanjaro and to do RAM. And I had met with Dr. Deming a couple different times. At one time, I thought I might need to have radiation, so I knew him, and I just sent him an email, and I said I was interested in participating in the RAM if they still had a slot, and he invited me to join the team after I finished recovering from my second surgery, which was in January of this year.
I am a mother of 2 kids, Drennan, and I ran a 10K the year after my daughter was born, and I was kind of proud of myself for that. So most people wouldn't even imagine doing a bicycle race of this magnitude the year after a child's born, let alone 6 months after you just finished cancer treatment. Why did you want to do this?
Well, I think there are many reasons. But when you're faced with a cancer diagnosis, everything in your life just completely stops. And from that day forward, everything's different. And you realize that, you know, you're faced with your own mortality at whatever age that might be. And you realize that whatever dream you might have, you know, you might need to act on that right away, because you don't know, none of us know how much time we have left on this planet. And it was important to me for my children, because they are so young, that I wanted to show them that anything is possible. This is something that was an incredible journey, and for me to be able to be an example for them and for other cancer survivors, I think it's just, I'm just very fortunate.
Dr. Deming, Drennan's story is similar to Dave's story, and I've talked to a couple other people who have participated in your journeys. It sounds like you get a lot of emails. You get a lot of people walking up to you and saying, well, maybe I should do this. How do you decide who goes on these journeys with you?
Great question. There's a little bit of a difference from the mountain climbing journeys to the bicycle race. So when we first started with Everest Base Camp, it was just going to be a once-in-a-lifetime journey, and we really didn't even exist as an entity, so it was word of mouth. After we had the opportunity to share that experience with the public and launch the Kilimanjaro climb, we had many more applicants than we were able to accommodate. And it's a matter of reading their applications, their essays. And the real purpose of Above and Beyond Cancer isn't to get cancer survivors to the tops of mountains. It's not like there's a world shortage of cancer survivors on the tops of the mountains and we're going to try to correct the world imbalance. It's how can these journeys transform individuals, and then how can the stories of these transformations allow us to bring others into the organization to do the real purpose of the organization, which is to advocate for better healthcare policy, to advocate for more funding for research, so that ultimately we can help reduce the burden of cancer. So we're looking for cancer survivors that are not only going to have a personal transformation, but that also have the potential to allow us to do the bigger job of advocacy. For the bicycle, for the Race Across America, I mean, we didn't just say, well, come join us, we'll teach you how to ride a bicycle, and we can get you across country. If it were a bicycle ride and we had 3 months, I'm pretty confident we could get pretty much anybody across country. But this was a race. So for the Race Across America, we were looking for people who are already, you know, experienced bicyclists.
And Drennan, a lot of people, I know that you've been on a number of RAGBRAIs, what, 19 RAGBRAIs?
Yeah.
In the past, so you are a cyclist. But when I know a number of cancer survivors, and they've talked about that recovery period and how difficult it is to get their strength back and really start feeling like themselves again. You were doing this so shortly after your treatment. Were you able to feel like you got your strength back by the time the race started?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, at times I think I question that because, you know, I maybe put a lot of pressure on myself. However, I think it actually helped me because it helped me. It motivated me to get back into shape. And, you know, being pregnant, I had 2 children in 2 years, and then I went through my cancer treatment. And so I felt that I needed to get back into shape, and this really motivated me. And as I started to get stronger physically, I started to get stronger mentally and emotionally, and they just all kind of came together. And by the time we started the race, I mean, I really haven't felt better in my life, to be honest.
Wow.
It's amazing to watch the transformation. The 5 cancer survivors that were the heart and soul of our team. I mean, they are incredible people, but to come together with this 3,000-mile bicycle race and to work out with them for 9 months and to see the physical strength develop, but also the confidence and courage that comes with it, and the mind, body, spirit growth that happens as we come together. As I said, our secret weapon was this higher purpose that allowed us to not only complete the bicycle race, but actually do it in a time none of us had imagined was going to be possible.
Well, let's talk about that. So you had to meet a time check in Durango, Colorado?
Yes, that was the first official point at which we could get disqualified if we weren't fast enough. And that's before the Continental Divide. And we made it there with at least 12 hours to spare. And I think, for me personally, I knew then we had it in the bag. We had it. We were so strong, and we were focused, and we were were really doing well. We went up and over the Continental Divide, and on the backside, as we entered into Kansas, we had a little bit of a crisis. I think really the only crisis that we experienced, and that was due to, at that point, 3 days into the race, a lot of sleep deprivation and fatigue. And I have to stress, it wasn't just the 8 bicycle riders. It was 12 crew, drivers of 2 vans and an RV. And we're all moving, all 20 of us moving across country. So as you try to eat and sleep and drink and rest, you're continuing to move across country. And the drivers were really stressed. They, at night, we were pedaling day and night, and at night the drivers had to drive about 10 feet behind the bicyclists to provide illumination as we went up and over the winding roads. And when you start to get sleepy as a driver of a vehicle, it gets a little scary. And so we had a moment where we stopped pedaling for about 15 minutes and came together as a team and said, you know, we don't have to do this. We don't have to complete, but we do have to make sure that everyone is safe. And we realized that it would be better to have a few additional crew. So some of our friends of Above and Beyond Cancer from back in Des Moines drove down to Kansas, joined the crew. We had a few more people to drive the vans, and we continued on even stronger than we were before. And we're able to complete the 3,000-mile bicycle race in 6 days, 21 hours, and 17 minutes. I still can't believe it.
So in completing that race, you've made it very clear, Dr. Deming, that you wanted people to know that your riders, the cancer survivors on this journey, were riding because they had cancer, not in spite of their cancer, that cancer was the starting point for this journey in many ways. Why is that important to make that distinction?
You know, it's through difficulties that we really prove who we are and what we can do. And ultimately, life is difficulties. And for someone to be able to take adversity like cancer, to grow from it, to learn their own strength, and then instead of just resting on their laurels, to realize that journey allows them to reach for something that's even tougher and even more difficult, knowing that regardless of whether they succeed or not, that attempting to take on a challenge will provide incredible strength. Also, all the cancer survivors have learned and taught those of us who haven't had cancer that, you know, if diamonds were as plentiful as grains of sand, they would be worthless. If we lived forever, wasting one day of our life would be trivial. But we don't live forever, and it makes it even more important to live each day with authenticity and passion and compassion. And as Drennan said, to leave your daughter, your son, with this memory of being able to do whatever you want to do. And it's not about how many days you live. It's how you live your many days.
Dr. Richard Deming, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Charity.
And Drennan, thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Drennan Fisher is a 38-year-old breast cancer survivor, a mother of 2, and an attorney from Cumming, Iowa. Dr. Richard Deming is the director of Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines and founder of Above and Beyond Cancer. We were talking today about the 3,000-mile Race Across America bicycle race that they both participated in June. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support from John Pemble in Des Moines. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.